taking calcium without the proper protein matrix won't allow the calcium really to incorporate itself into the bone properly. It's just there, so it looks good on x-ray, but really has no positive function as far as even rigidity is concerned. But the detriment is that as we age, cells have a harder and harder time keeping calcium out. As you mentioned, we have kind of calcium sump pumps that constantly have to pump the calcium out. As we age, our ability to do that decreases. But then what they say is to take more calcium, which is like having a sump pump in a basement and making sure that it's raining all the time. As the sump pump is getting a bit older, and it's really not as effective at keeping water out or the calcium out, and then you're making sure that it's raining all the time, you're saying, make sure you take 2 grams of calcium a day, which to your cell is like raining calcium. The ability to keep calcium out becomes much more difficult, and intracellular calcium rises. And when intracellular calcium rises, virtually all signaling processes in the cell, of all kinds of cells, not just bone-forming cells, we're talking about heart cells, we're talking about nerve cells, we're talking about kidney cells. Every cell that you're made of, this is relevant for. As calcium starts building up in cells and cells start losing signals because there's too much static inside the cell, they can't hear the right messages, everything becomes impaired and you die, which is why the Swedish study showed that mortality rate increases as serum calcium goes up.
You know, the American Dairy Council is not going to like this interview.
Oh, nobody likes me. I'm not just focusing on them. I focus on everybody.
Although there is some evidence that taking calcium supplements is actually more problematic than eating foods that are higher in calcium. And perhaps that's because if you take a supplement that has something that your body doesn't need, it's harder to get rid of it than when it's packaged with other nutrients.
And it might not even probably get absorbed as well.
If it's just food.
Your body has a better way to get rid of it, right? It goes in and out.
You and Walt Willett would agree. Walt Willett is with the Harvard School of Nutrition.
Yeah.
And he says, if you really want strong bones, don't milk your cow. Take your cow for a walk.
That sounds good.
Walking and exercise really do help our bones because it helps them flex, which makes them wake up and say, oh my gosh, it's time to...
We need more strength.
And we need to clear out some stuff that's not flexing well and get those osteoclasts going and get those osteoblasts going. And all of that works as long as you haven't taken an anti-inflammatory that means that the bones don't get the signal to be repairing themselves.
That's correct. Exactly right. Just like if you want to build your muscle, you exercise your muscle. You know, if you want to build the strength of your arms, you'll do arm exercises. If you want to build the strength of your bone, you need to do bone exercises. Exercise your bones.
Well, I've got an idea. Since bones have protein in them, how about if people eat more protein?
Boils down to what we just said a little while ago. It's not so much the parts that even make life. It's how they're integrated. It's the organization of those parts. So if you have hormones that tell your protein what to do, if you have hormones that tell calcium where to go, then you're going to be healthy. If you don't, you can take all the calcium you want. There's not going to be a homing pigeon attached to that calcium that tells it to go to your bone. The calcium has no idea that it's supposed to go to your bone or whether it should go to your artery or your kidney or your gallbladder. It's just calcium. You know, it doesn't have the knowledge. We have to give it the knowledge of what to do. Same with protein. You can't just take protein and sit on a couch and watch television and expect your muscles to grow. You know, that's not going to happen. If you don't have signals to build muscle, you won't. If you don't have signals to build the strength of bone, essentially conferred by the protein content of the bone, then it's not going to happen. You can take all the protein you want. It's not going to end up in your bone. You're going to end up burning it as fuel, and that's going to be detrimental. Burning protein as a fuel source is highly unhealthy.
All right. That's a quick primer in some things that can help your bones be stronger and some things that can interfere.
Eat your green vegetables and take your vitamin K. Don't listen to your doctor.
How about the hormones that may influence healthy bones and the healthy bones that can influence hormones, such as insulin and leptin? Gerald Carenzi, he gave one of the leading lectures at the American Association for Advancement of Science because of his remarkable research where he discovered that serotonin in the brain, the feel-good hormone, if it's coming from the brain, sends signals to strengthen bones. Leptin from the brain sends signals to strengthen bones. Serotonin, created inside of our intestines, inside of our duodenum, which is just down below the stomach. If serotonin is being created there, it actually interferes and dampens down how much healthy bone the body will be making. And what he has discovered is that these hormones, not only do they make a difference in how the body's building bone, but it depends on where in the body the hormone comes from. This is very confusing. How would you unconfuse it?
I'm not sure I can, particularly. The body is extremely intricate in its information disseminating orchestration. One of the keys to health is really how signals are orchestrated, not whether you have them or whether you don't, or how much you have or how much you don't have, but how they're orchestrated. An example would be antioxidants. Everybody wants to take antioxidants these days. University of Colorado, there's a whole institute of antioxidant research. But I think they're all missing the boat in that it's not how much antioxidant capacity you do. They do ORAC studies that measure how powerful the antioxidant capability is of a particular supplement, for instance, and if it has a really high ORAC score, it becomes promoted, you know, as pomegranate juice or ACAI, you know, is real popular because it's very high in antioxidants. You hear that all over the place, and it's totally fallacious. You know, it has nothing to do with health because we need oxidation. You know, breathing is oxidation. You can't kill cancer without oxidation or viruses or bacteria. It's not whether you have it or whether you don't. It's where, when, and how you have it. It has to be orchestrated. So you want it here and you don't want it there. You want it now, you don't want it then. And that orchestration is through proper hormones. And those hormones, more often than not, have to do with nutrient availability and reproduction, because that's what life is about. You know, that for life to perpetuate, you need to know when it's the proper time to reproduce and what the nutrient availability is, because that's necessary to reproduce. And so the hormones that are essential in indicating nutrient availability and nutrient use and its integration with reproduction then have its fingers in everything else.
Well, Gerald Kerensky, I believe, would agree with that. When it comes to bone, he's not talking about making lots of baby bone, but I guess in a way he is. Mm-hmm. We think about reproduction as, you know, babies and offspring. And with bone, he is saying that it's an energy-intensive process to make bone. And so if the body doesn't have enough resources, if it's low on energy, it's not a time to put into building and refreshing bone. If the energy resources are sending signals that there aren't enough, then bone will get weaker, is part of what he's saying. And that has to do with the signals from the brain that there's enough of resources to make more bone. So that's one thing he's saying. It's very energy intensive to make bone. And that's one reason that he thinks that leptin evolved at the same time as our internal bones did, because it was important to have an overall energy balance resource looking at this to say, when can we build bone?
Yeah. Leptin is really a crucial hormone having to do with virtually all facets of health and disease. I've maintained now for quite a few years that unless leptin is acting properly, if it's not being signaled correctly, not necessarily high or not necessarily low, but signaled properly, when to be high, when to be low, there is no other modality that one can do to be healthy. You have to get leptin right first, and then other things can help. And the only way you can get leptin right is to eat properly. That's why proper dietary nutrition is so important to me, because it affects the hormones that are instrumental in indicating to the body and brain what the nutrient availability is, and therefore then what the genetic expression is of maintenance, repair, or reproduction. All of that is extremely critical and all aspects of health. For instance, it's deemed that the body has to live longer to be able to reproduce at a future more opportune time. It's probably going to want stronger bones. If you've essentially been given your opportunity to reproduce, then the body doesn't care so much whether your bones are stronger and whether you have osteoporosis or not. And then we have to go essentially to what I would call unnatural modalities, not necessarily following nature, but seeing how nature gave us strong bones to begin with and then maintain it. It's not that nature wants us to die after reproductive age. It just doesn't care whether we do or not. If we do, great. If we don't, great. But we can use nature's tricks to be able to live a very long, healthy, happy post-reproductive lifespan if we follow what nature is telling us to do.
Well, and you know, maybe nature does want us to live a longer time even after reproduction, because we're not like salmon. We don't just get to the point where the male and female salmon work hard to swim upstream and then they just live just long enough to mate and lay the eggs.
And then, yeah, there is parenting, so there is a certain post-reproductive span that might be necessary, even for grandparents. But we're talking about even beyond that. You know, maybe we can live longer than what nature has thought we were necessary for.
And maybe if we do, maybe that will be an evolutionary advantage because of all of the wisdom that comes from experience if people are healthy. So maybe there's a real benefit to the society. So to get there, when it comes to our bones.
Yeah, well, mobility is certainly one of the sine qua nons of health. Mobility was definitely required for our evolutionary adaptation.
And for mobility, we need good bones. And leptin is an interesting detail because there is evidence that very overweight people can have very strong bones. People who are very overweight often have very high levels of leptin. On the other hand, there's also evidence that having very low levels of leptin, if a person's cells are leptin sensitive, is one of the best possibilities for building and strengthening bones that are too weak. So this is a paradox here.
Not so much a paradox, yeah. It's what we were mentioning before. It's important not to confuse a hormone level with the strength of the signal. So, for instance, we know that in the vast majority of diabetics, classified as type 2, they have high insulin, but the activity of insulin is very low. Actually, that's not exactly correct. It's low in the so-called blood glucose controlling aspect of it, high in the cell multiplication aspect. Actually, you lose the orchestration, which is what the problem of diabetes is. In other words, the high insulin generally means in the liver is not listening as well. It kind of lost its hearing and noise exposure. It's like being exposed to so much noise, you can't hear it anymore. The same happens in muscle tissue, that the muscles can't hear insulin properly, so they can't burn sugar properly. Since the liver is not listening to insulin properly, it makes too much sugar, all these contributing to high blood sugar, and so a person becomes diabetic. But the high insulin is not toned down in certain processes that instigate cell division, and so the high insulin is then a risk for increased cancer.
So for our cells that multiply a lot, like our gut lining, and in a woman, breast tissue linings of things, all of those epithelial cells, they're more prone to cancer when insulin levels are high.
Prostate,
because it's also, that has to do with tubes with linings of cells that never become insulin resistant, so they're just sitting ducks.
They're sitting ducks. And even in the same cell now, we know that certain processes, like the metabolic processes of insulin, are toned down with insulin resistance, but other processes, the RAS process, which has to do with cell division, are not toned down. You know, so even the same cell in the same organ, different processes. So it's the orchestration that's lost. And this is really kind of a sine qua non of ill health, is what you'll see. One must look way beyond just hormone levels. You have to look at the strength of a hormone signal and where, as you're saying, with serotonin, the strength of the hormone signaling in the intestines or the brain, and where is it going to?
If levels are high in people that are obese and their bones may be stronger, it's hard to tell because the high signal means that part of their body is leptin resistant. It's not understanding. It's thinking it's starving. But in some way, it may be helping the bones. But if a signal of leptin is low and the cells are sensitive to the signal, then that can be enough signal to tell the bones there's enough energy to go ahead and build more bone without all of the other mess that comes from being leptin resistant.
Yeah, and we know that there's a dichotomy in leptin signaling, just like insulin signaling, where high leptin generally indicates leptin resistance, and much of the end organs for leptin become resistant, and many of these end organs are in the brain, but the sympathetic nervous system, which is at least partially controlled by leptin, doesn't become resistant. And so the parts of the hypothalamus, for instance, that indicate or that regulate hunger and obesity become resistant to leptin. So you have high leptin, but the arcuate nucleus in the hypothalamus is hearing low leptin, which would keep a person hungry and tell a person that they're too skinny even though they're fat, and make a person make more fat and not burn what they have, which is one of the major causes, if not the major cause, of obesity in the world. You have too much leptin, so your body's trying to tell your brain you've got too much fat, that you're going to get eaten by a lion, you're not going to be an effective hunter, you're not going to be able to run away from a saber-toothed tiger, that you better lose some of that fat or you're going to die. But the brain is hearing a different message. The brain then, or at least that portion of the brain in the arcuate nucleus, is hearing that you're too skinny, you're not going to be able to survive a famine, you better be hungry, you better make more fat, and you better conserve the fat that you've got. So there's a disconnect.
Those two parts of the brain are sitting pretty much side by side, and they're hearing totally different messages.
And the worst part is, in any type of communication, what's important is what you hear, not what's being said. And so that portion that's hearing that you have too little leptin, even though you have too much, is going to make you fatter until you make more and more and more leptin, so that it can scream then to the arcuate nucleus. Arcuate nucleus now in the hypothalamus gets the message that you've got enough fat. Not too much. You might have 200 extra pounds of fat now. The arcuate nucleus is thinking now, you've got just enough. But you're producing massive amounts of leptin, which is telling other areas of your brain that regulate the sympathetic nervous system, for instance, that your heart's going to beat too fast, you're going to have high blood pressure, and that's going to increase your risk of cancer and diabetes, and it's going to make you produce a lot more blood sugar through the vagus nerve that goes to the liver, so that your liver produces way too much sugar. It then controls insulin and your thyroid and causes all sorts of reproductive problems.
Everything gets more extreme. Some of the feedback loops that rev things up, rev up more. Some of the feedback loops that rev down, rev things down more. Mm-hmm. It all gets out of balance.
It gets out of balance, and that out of balanceness is extremely complicated. Medical knowledge is nowhere close to the point where they could regulate all of those imbalances correctly.
Translated, you're saying you don't think a drug is going to solve this.
Translated correctly. In fact, a drug is going to make it worse, almost for sure.
Serotonin is what most people think of when they think of antidepressants. That if your serotonin levels are low, supposedly, that's what makes somebody feel depressed, even though there's some data that says it's not that they're low. It's that if your cells are resistant to the influence of serotonin, you can feel depressed, whether or not it's the signal or whether the signal's heard. There's a debate about that. But most people know serotonin because of drugs that can make you have more serotonin in your body. Serotonin is also known as something that helps during labor for women, because it causes pretty strong muscle contractions, I think, is what it does. But serotonin causing better bone growth? Turns out that serotonin from the brain improves the likelihood of strong bones. But serotonin in the digestive tract reduces the chance of strong bones.
I don't know what to say.
So I'm wondering about this, because this is weird. I mean, here's some things that Gerald Krensky, I believe, is saying, which I'd like to ask him about someday, and I'm curious what you're curious about. One is that when someone takes an antidepressant, it can actually interfere with bone strength. Yeah. It's a slight effect, but it's there.
Yeah, and I don't doubt it. And nature is really thrifty. There's literally thousands of, in fact, much more the rule than the exception, where a particular chemical or signal or hormone is used for a wide variety of different functions. Much easier to take something that's already there and give it a new function than create something totally new. And so having serotonin from the brain do one thing and serotonin from the intestines do something else would not be surprising in the least. And I think the rules of hormone resistance, I think, are universal. In most cases, you could probably make a case that any hormone one can develop resistance to if it's not used properly or if it's overused in particular. So if you have constant high levels of estrogen, you're going to become estrogen resistant. But that resistance isn't going to be uniform. Some tissues are going to become more resistant than other tissues. And that's really why it is impossible to treat medically. because you can't then just take more estrogen, or you can't just take more insulin because then you can't orchestrate it. So for instance, one of the problems in type 1 diabetics, and they'll say, well, you can always take the insulin even though your body's not producing it. Well, not exactly, because when your own body produces insulin, your pancreas will produce it, and there is a direction to where that insulin goes. So there's a big bolus from the pancreas directly to the liver to shut off glucose production, and then from the liver it goes to the rest of the body. When you take insulin by shot, it's going, you know, right under the skin, and you lose that direction first to the liver. So the liver gets no higher a dose than anywhere else. And the same is true for any type of hormone. It isn't just how much you have, it's where you have it. And so if it's produced by the brain or if it's produced by the intestines, there's going to be a different direction of circulation, different direction of where it goes and therefore what it does.
Then let's look at this serotonin paradox. I guess I've wondered whether if it's coming from the brain, it's a signal that has to do with telling the whole body to do something. But if it's coming from the gut, I find myself wondering, why is part of the digestive tract producing serotonin? And I'm wondering if it's a stress signal. I'm wondering if the intestines produce serotonin when for some reason they're stressed, because there is a stress component to serotonin production. And maybe if the digestion is stressed, that's a signal to the rest of the body, we need to repair the digestion. It's not a time to allocate resources to building bone. That's a guess.
Yeah, and it's a very good guess. And people have heard the adage, you know, I've got a feeling in my gut, you know, and I think there was a book written a number of years ago that talks about the gut's brain. You know, you can consider your gut as having its own brain. And so that serotonin might be one of the brain neurotransmitters in the gut that allows it to have a gut feeling.
Well, maybe then that's a question. If I were to dream of asking Gerald Crency some questions about these discoveries of his, maybe that would be one. Why does the gut produce serotonin? What is the advantage to it of having this hormone produced? That's one. What kind of questions would you want to have him asked?
Why there would be a kind of an opposite action on bone? You know, why would serotonin from the gut produce a detriment in bone formation as opposed to serotonin from the brain?
He's wondering that too, having heard a speech that he gave, and I believe that he said that, to his knowledge, this is the first example of a hormone where its action is different when it's produced in the brain versus when it's produced below the brain. Now, does that mean that as we look, we'll find no other hormone that this happens, or does this mean that as people start looking for differences between brain and body hormones that we will see more and more that have opposite actions?
Yeah, I think it'll probably be more the rule than the exception, knowing how the body works. It's just really intricate, which is why it's much easier to deal with it from its root than, you know, try and get all the tentacles correct. You know, that would just be impossible, I really think. That's why drug therapy for this is really a hopeless cause.
Well, if somebody wants to build bone, you would want them to eat a diet that has their hormones signals nice and clear without getting them resistant in any way. And exercise would be fine. Since serotonin is a stress hormone, then maybe finding ways in addition to diet to reduce stress.
Yeah. And just going back to that, it even gets more complicated than we're making it out. For instance, we know that serotonin and dopamine kind of work together, and the dopamine to serotonin ratios are important in the brain, and I would assume elsewhere also. And so if you take so-called, you know, SSRI drugs like Prozac that raise serotonin by preventing their breakdown, one of the major problems with it is, number one, you develop resistance to serotonin, which makes it worse than when you started, and number two, you mess up the serotonin to dopamine ratios, which then messes up dopamine function too. Dopamine is extremely important in all sorts of things, in, you know, the pleasure center, getting enjoyment out of life, in addictions. Until we can know what we're doing with all aspects of the effects of all hormones, you know basically how it's affecting the entire orchestration of the music that our body is playing, we shouldn't be messing with it because we're going to make it worse.
You know, when I think about drugs that change the hormone ratios in the body, it's interesting to me that our bodies work so hard just to use a little bit of these hormones and then clear them out as quickly as they can. They just send a puff of one of these hormones into the body, and then the body works very hard to clear it out. I don't know whether it's because too much is dangerous or that it's not good for the body to have stale hormones hanging around, that if the hormones are in the bloodstream very long, they get oxidized, they get dinged up, they may not act as well. So the body's always working to put them in and then quickly take them out so that their half-lives are just a few minutes quite often. It's not like these hormones are there for hours on end. And antidepressants are often selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which mean that they slow down how long those hormones are in the body. They make them be stale hormones. And I don't know whether that means that their action can be messed up a bit because they've been there too long, or that if they're there very long, there's certain cells that start to burn out on them or get hurt by having too much of it there.
I'm sure that's all correct, but it has to do, I think, with the language that the body speaks. Like we're talking, you know, I'm talking right now. The voice is determined as much by the silent areas as the noisy areas. So if I'm trying to say a word, but I don't shut off the W, or if I don't shut off the word and it just merges right into the next, we're not going to be able to hear that sentence very well. In any type of language, it's important to have a noise and then shut it off, and have it here and not have it there. I mean, that's what communication is.
Now, you're a fan of high-fat, low-carb diets. Do you think that that kind of way to eat, high-fat, low-carb, adequate protein, what would that do to bones?
I think it does to bones what it can do everywhere else, and that is make them healthier. And the reason for that is I've measured thousands of leptin levels and insulin levels and found that that sort of diet maximizes the accuracy of insulin and leptin signaling. Now we know that other signals pertaining to protein, such as mTOR, are going to be maximized also. And when I say maximized, I don't mean levels. Actually, you're lowering them. By lowering all three of them, you keep the signal and you keep the communication. What that accuracy tells the body is to upregulate genetic expression of maintenance and repair, which amounts then to longevity. So the body will do what it can to live longer because it thinks it's necessary. It gives the body what it deems to be a purpose to live longer. Strong bones are a part of that.
Well, and that means that those little osteoclasts and osteoblasts can get in there and do the job they're meant to do.
Right. I think there's very robust science now that shows how relevant leptin is in bone formation and strength. That was in the journal Science maybe 8-9 years ago, I suppose. They showed that proper leptin signaling in the brain, meaning reduced leptin resistance, the way you reduce leptin resistance, if you have it, as indicated by high leptin, is by lowering the leptin, not by raising it more. And so as you lower it, you increase the leptin sensitivity of significant areas in the brain, which then through the central mechanism and through nerves actually then stimulate osteoblastic activity so that bones make more protein. And that gives it more flexibility, which conveys strength, and then also allows the calcium to accumulate in the bone so that it doesn't accumulate, and this is kind of a simplistic view, doesn't accumulate as much in the arteries.
Or in the joints, or...
or elsewhere in the body, right.
Before we finish up, just as a hypothetical, every now and then there's a child born who does not make bone very well. And it's somewhat of a genetic condition.
Called osteogenesis imperfecta is the name of that condition. They get fractures very, very similar to the type of fractures that women are getting on all the osteoporosis drugs. Their bones are like glass.
And so we can assume that a child like that, they don't make as good a protein matrix for the bone to build onto.
And that's what it is. It is a specific genetic defect in an enzyme necessary to manufacture bony protein. Their condition is exactly like you would see in women taking osteoporotic drugs, where it looks great on x-ray, they have the minerals, but they don't have the protein there to hold those minerals together. And so their bones are almost like dust. They fracture their bones very repeatedly, which isn't the bad part, but the kind of fractures that they get are what are bad. You know, very difficult to heal. They're not a single fracture. They're almost always multiple compound fractures.
Well, that one sounds like one where the ideal solution would be to somehow get that child more of that enzyme.
In that particular case, that would be exactly what one would have to do. You know, genetic modification, increase the enzyme. But in the average person, it generally isn't a defect in one's ability. They didn't inherit an inability to manufacture the enzyme. That enzyme is not getting the signal to become active.
Well, could that be also the case in these kids? If they ate differently, is there anything they could do to perhaps give them a little bit more margin for not breaking bones?
I would think that that would be the case, following the diet that you're very familiar with, that I've recommended to improve leptin signaling. It improves then testosterone signaling. Testosterone, by the way, is also very important in bone growth, and it's one of the reasons, for instance, that obese women or men have stronger bones. It might have nothing to do, at least not totally, with leptin, but also other hormones that leptin very much affects, such as estrogen. And if a person is fat, they make more estrogen because the fat cells themselves make more estrogen. And that estrogen then can turn to testosterone, which is good for the bone, not so good for everything else. So they increase their risk of certain cancers and things like that. Again, you lose the orchestration, but not everything is bad. You know, as a byproduct of some of the mess up in hormone signaling, they get stronger bones, almost by luck, actually.
Better yet would be to have better hormone signaling and stronger bones, and there may be a pathway for that.
And that way you get thinner with stronger bones. You don't have to be fat then and produce all sorts of extraneous, exogenous estrogen that wouldn't be so great.